Yes, this week with On My Stoop with Ray, I wanted to introduce some political discourse. I think it's an important thing that we do that here at the station. So I wanted to first talk about the history of this area and why political discourse is so fundamentally important to the folks in Baltimore and Maryland in general. Back in the good old days when we were English citizens, there was a Protestant movement against the Catholic Church. This led to the creation of the Church of England and the creation of Protestantism. Sorry about that. As being the primary movement in the country. And Catholics were actually made illegal. They had to go underground to practice their religion. Right about the time of Jamestown, Queen Elizabeth was the queen, and she wanted to give Catholics the chance in the new land to practice a religion, and also to pay them back for some of the persecution that they experienced. So at the time, they assigned Lord Baltimore these lands north of Jamestown in Virginia called Maryland. Now, Maryland was actually, the name was based on Queen Mary, who was the beloved Catholic queen before Elizabeth came around, and she was very much beloved by the Catholics. And so Lord Baltimore took over this area called Maryland. Back then, I guess it might have been termed Maryland. So it basically what happened is an assembly of Maryland's greatest citizens, one of our first citizens, led by Edward Edmund Stead, who established a colony on a tobacco farm on the Choptank. And he and the fellow citizens met in this small town in the area. And they actually created a position where they are the ones that put together legislation that's considered before the king. So that basically I guess it's kind of hard to explain, but it's established a tradition of democracy that was unheard of at the time. We've always been Maryland and Baltimore, the city that is named after Lord Baltimore, have always been in the forefront of change and liberty and government movement. For instance, when the Capitol was burned back in the War of 1812, citizens gathered from all around the area and fortified in what was then called Hampstead Hill, is now Patterson Park. So, basically, we've had this tradition of being in the forefront of things. So sometimes, I kind of laugh when, I've always been down in D.C., and they consider Baltimore a suburb of Washington. When I first decided to move into this neighborhood, I found out it was quite the opposite. That Baltimore has a very distinctive political history. They have their own economy, their own things going on. Totally independent, and so many great things have happened in this neighborhood alone, in the neighborhood of Fowles Point. Where along there we've had our pubs and our taverns, and citizens have always gotten together during these major times and created political debate. Now it's very important because we are next-door neighbor of Washington. We also have many folks from Washington, D.C., moving into Baltimore, moving into the area, and actually commuting back and forth. So all these things were on my mind that, you know, Baltimore, you know, we are concerned. We are concerned about what happens to our great nation and how I wanted to make politics and political discourse a part of this radio station and occasional good part of my show on my stoop with Ray. And I was discussing this with my good friend, Big Ed. All right. I met Big Ed over, you know, for a little while ago. And I said, you know, I'm looking for someone to do some political discourse and somebody that, you know, we could kind of bounce some ideas off of. And here he was. And let me tell you about our relationship a bit, Ed. I love Big Ed because, you know, first we started just bullshitting with each other, and then we're playing music together with the Bill Billings Band without Annette over at Ledbetter's. And, you know, just I got to know him through that situation, and he's a sound guy. And you also help with, you know, security sometimes at these events and at these bars. You're kind of like, you know, I see you as doorman. You know, a doorman. Okay, politically yeah. correct, yeah. A doorman. All right, yeah. All right. You know, that's cool. But you know, but then I come to find that you are known as a local political guy, and that you know, yeah. and that you have a you know, I find your views to be very interesting. So I'm gonna leave it at that. To ask you, you know. What are some of your political philosophies and your leanings and some of your life experiences that have brought you to, you know, your opinions?
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, you're very well correct in mentioning, you know, my life's experience on these things. You know, ever since I was a young boy, I grew up in a lower class part of town, somewhat lower class, but it was all labor. It was the ILA, it was the railroads, it was a lot of different unions, and it started to open my eyes to a lot of things. I started seeing, you know, a lot about life. You know, I started, you know, when I started you know, opening my eyes to politics and things outside the immediate neighborhood, you know, I was, you know, still on the end of Edward R. Murrow and, you know, some of the great, you know, people from the Fourth Estate, you know, that really had propelled this country, that had given information.
Great journalists.
Yeah, great journalists, which, like I said, you know, the very first thing in our, you know, or I didn't say, but the very first thing in our Constitution is the establishment of the Fourth Estate. You know, I believe our forefathers, had realized that, you know, well, not only, you know, if we're going to make our own country, we are going to need somebody that's not of the country as our weather vane. And that's why the very first, you know, the very first thing in the Constitution was for our Fourth Estate, journalism. But anyway, you know, with that and becoming open to a lot of different ideas, I started filtering through, and it really got me to basically stick with a lot of labor and social issues, and I started to realize the difference between, you know, the basic difference between a republic and a democracy. Since then, I've been involved with labor. I've been involved with social issues. Thank God for the internet, because, you know, since the internet came out, it was so much easier to get all these bills from Capitol Hill and, you know, read them. You know, instead of having to, you know, constantly go to the newspapers, constantly trying to, you know, find information other ways through the library and whatever. So, you know, that's that's a great thing for democracy.
I agree. So, yeah.
But, you know, I started doing all this probably around, you know, the late 60s, early 70s. You know, just barely preteen and teen. And I've always had an interest in it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all pretty right. much it.
We talked about, you know, I mean, what you just mentioned, the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. And this is one of the issues that actually has been troubling me a bit, because it seems like in this topsy-turvy world, even we forget what we really believe in. So I wanted to examine the original definitions of what traditional definitions, because I said through history, we could always look and see what the development.
Well, I think it's a slippery slope there.
Okay.
If you look at the Constitution, you know, I don't mean to harp on the Constitution, but
sure,
you know, it's the original idea that was put together by people. And, you know, the idea was that, you know, who makes the decisions? Why do they make the decisions? But most importantly, when they make decisions. If you look at the presidency, that was deemed 4 years. The Senate, that's 6 years. The House of Representatives, that's 2 years at a time. Now, why did they pick those? They are a random number. Well, from my information, I don't have it handy with me now. But from my information and reading, you know, our documents, one of the biggest things our founding fathers on any side had realized that each generation has to account and has to face their own decisions and make their own decisions. Because the generations before us, you know, they made decisions for themselves. They can't see into the future. They couldn't see 20, 50, 100 years into the future to see what we're doing. So, you know, the basis of our government is based on that government changes. That is in a constant change. As we know with life, the only constant is change. And if there's going to be a constant government, it has to continuously change. So
through revolution, as Jefferson.
Well, if it gets to a point of revolution,
okay,
yeah. But if it can be at most civil, and that's why the reading the documents, it was
disobedience.
Civil disobedience is fine. Wow. You know, so civil war. I mean, you know, if it gets to that, that's what it has to be. But the way we're set up, you know, the civil war in one sense almost shouldn't have happened. But then again, that's where we were, and that's the technology that we had too. You know, in today's technology, you know, I don't see that as so much a possibility. But civil disobedience, you know, when it's necessary. Yeah, I'm totally for that. But that's how we were set up. You know, everything's put into place.
Thomas Paine was into civil disobedience.
But
right?
But if you look at the preamble of the Constitution, mm-hmm. the preamble, it says, I think the preamble is the most important part. The laws under it are only roadmaps to get to what the preamble says. And the preamble specifically states for the social good, you know, for the benefit, the welfare of the people, you know. How many people do you know that can, you know, that even know that preamble is there? You know, I talked to a lot of people about, you know, the Constitution, and I asked them about the preamble, and they're like, what does that have to do with anything?
Uh-huh.
You know, they just look at that as more or less like, you know, a title at the top. But, you know, that's a very relevant part. But, you know,
right. people don't seem to see the need to follow what's said.
Follow the preamble. The preamble basically says this is what we want. And this is our heart's content. Following, we have laws, enumerated laws, on how to get there,
mm-hmm.
you know. But you can take you if you just focus on those laws, if you just focus on those laws, you know, you can make them pretty much speak any phrase you want. You know, it's the old attorney's game. You know, mm-hmm. Law basically, as it's become known, isn't so much about, you know, justice and truth. It's about the role and who got to that role first. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do with justice and truth, mm-hmm. you know. But the preamble is the justice and truth of, you know, what we were supposed to stand for.
Our soul, perhaps.
Yeah, our soul, you know. We're people fleeing from someone who said, this is the way it's going to be, and you have nothing to say about it. Or you have very little to say about it. And we, you know, first thing, that's, to me, that's horrible. You know, mm-hmm. you know, if I'm on the face of Earth, I'm somebody. You know, I have a right to speak, you mm-hmm. know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It goes back to, John Locke. John Locke. And then John Locke, I believe, is one of the most misunderstood political figures, as well, actually philosophical writers in history. Okay. You know, he's, you know, everybody grabs a little quote here and there, you know, that John Locke said. You know, most of our founding three documents, you can take most of those words right out of John Locke's, you know, Essay on Governments 1 and 2 and Essay on Nature.
You really? Know, I'm not even...
John Locke?
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I'd like to say here to anybody out there listening, if you really, really want to be serious about politics, about, you know, the civil discourse and understanding all this and not be pulled around by a bunch of memes, you know, and quotes, there's a series from Harvard and, You can watch it on the internet. Yeah, excuse me for a second. I can't. But he goes down. I can't remember his name.
Okay.
I mean, well. But it's called Justice. What's the Right Thing to Do?
Okay. Well, that's probably enough for people to.
Yeah. Find. Yeah, and it's about a 10-part series, 2 hours each. That he goes down through all the philosophers, and especially the political philosophers, and has a class on it. It's the largest class ever at Harvard. It's the most, you know, most taught class ever in the history of Harvard and probably any institution. But you can learn a lot about John Locke and others that have, you know, their writings are directly in our founding three documents.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and it is fascinating because history does provide us with, you know, a framework, you know, but I think you're absolutely right. Every generation has its own call where they have to decide. And I'm wondering if, as we sit there and we look at such issues as, you know, the NSA, what's going on with Snowden, what's going on with, you know, Syria and Benghazi and all these different things, you know. Are we in a point where are we deciding, you know, where the government is a republic or, as you said, is more of a, what did you term it, a more liberal?
Democracy.
Democracy. Right.
Yeah. A republic or democracy, you know, right. a republic where you have appointed people, you know, making the decisions, or democracy, mm. you know, the majority of the people, you know, making mm. the decisions. But, mm. No, you know, things like, okay, let's take Benghazi. Let's get this right up front. You know, my job, I was in the Air Force, and my job in the Air Force was going around to a lot of the different, you know, American embassies mm-hmm. For one reason or another. I've served with these people. Now, you know, ever since the very beginning, it's been just a bunch, just been a lot of hoopla and holler about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, since then, mm-hmm. there's been four or five congressional investigations and committee investigations, and there's reports on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dead issue
mm-hmm.
for pretty much everybody but a handful of people that are politicizing it. Now, people talk about Benghazi and mm-hmm. the deaths in Benghazi, but nobody's talking about the previous 10 years where you've had over 200 deaths in American embassies, consulates, and other other things all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't hear a lot of people jump on that,
mm-hmm.
but why was this one jumped on? I think anybody can see that it's politics involved. It has nothing to do with the truth. That's another thing I'd like to end part here.
Okay.
You know, in the countries that I've been into, you go into a pub or you go into a gas stop or whatever, morning, afternoon, and night, and people are talking politics.
Absolutely.
Only in this country where you know, has the meme, oh, you don't talk about politics. You don't talk about politics. Well, you know, that's why we can't talk about politics. That's why so many people have a problem talking with politics and get so angry and start to yell and scream. It's because, one, they're not used to it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Hmm.
You know, all these other countries, I hear so much about Europe this, Europe that, you know. You know what? I lived there. I lived there a long time.
Good.
I've been in every single country over there. And you know what? Their lifestyle, they live damn good. You don't see the slums that they have. You don't see a lot of things. A few years ago, when France tried to take up the price on public education, the entire country pretty much shut down. You know, everything from the unions to the non-unions to, you know, they, you know, their politicians, you know, took that bill right off, right off the blotter. You know, it's because they're all so much more politically awake. You know, when you take part in society, you are agreeing with the laws of society.
Hmm. Do you think they're more of a republic, or, you know, can we continue to designate, or is that like an out? Is that not sufficient?
No, it's our growth as a country. It's also the growth of the human being.
Well,
we're coming from you know a section. You know, 250 years ago, the average person in this country didn't even have what we would consider a first grade education. More than 70% of the people could not read. You know. Nowadays, you know, needless to say, that's vastly changed. We're facing different issues. We have a different intelligence about it. The average person's intelligence is much more.
Well,
now, who's to say?
There's some hope for
us. Now, who's to say back then when we needed the smarter people, you know, to take control and guide us, that the republic was a thing to be?
Uh-huh. Right, okay.
Who's to say that now, with all the information that we have instantaneous communication across the world,
uh-huh.
right? Why can it not be more of a pure democracy now? I think that's why they called it, and that's why they set it up as a democratic republic, right?
Okay.
It's usually been run as a republic on the federal level. And it started out as a republic on the state levels, too. But then you started having a lot of changes where, you know, it became much more democratic. People don't realize it's only been 100 years where across the board in America, you voted for your own congressmen and your own senators. They were
right.
appointed nearly the first 100 years in this country. Did you know that? Most people don't know that. You know, they were appointed by the governor. So whoever the governor was, you know, or the assembly in some states, the assembly, they voted. And they said, you know, okay, our buddy John, he's going to be, you know, or whatever. You know, back then there was a lot more statesmanship, you know. But they saw things differently. I don't think we can see what they saw exactly. You know, we can take lessons from history, but I don't think we can see what they saw. And just as the same way, I don't think that, you know, they could have ever seen where we're at right now. And I think where we're at right now is not that bad. It's definitely not as bad as I believe pundits put it, you know. Okay. It could it be better? Yeah. Could it be worse? Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, but this is where we are.
Right. Well, you know, I think a lot of these questions are very relevant in light of what's been going on over at the NSA. Questions about I was just reading this court, FISA, I think it is.
FISA. The FISA court.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Do you remember that? Do you remember when FISA was set up?
No, actually, I don't.
The FISA courts were one of the things that had come out of the Patriot Act.
Right, you know? Absolutely. Okay, you know, I thought that.
I believe somewhere in the area within 1 or 2 years of 2004 or whatever. Oh. Now, back in 2006, you know, everyone knew, you know, the news broke, NSA has, you know, all the phone records and, you know, all the, you know, internet, whatever. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. This has been a continuing thing. Mm-hmm. This has been a continuing thing.
Well, that's one school of thought, definitely, that I find that, you know, some folks are, you know, it's been a continuing thing. So why be concerned?
Oh, no, I'm not saying don't be concerned. I'm saying this is a continuing thing. Why is it raising its head up right now? Yeah. I see almost as suspicious, but you know, yeah. I've been seeing under this administration a lot of things that when this administration got in, you know, one of the first things they got in on was transparency,
right?
But then right away Congress stopped that transparency on so many things. Look at the prison.
Prison?
The prison. The terrorist prison.
Oh, right. Guantanamo.
Guantanamo Bay. Right. Executive order was signed. Closed Guantanamo.
Yes.
Congress stopped it.
Yes.
Congress stopped it. You know, so it's all this big political battle, and it's not just that; it's so many other things. Congress stops, and sometimes they stop things by funding it. You know, so right. You know,
sure, they have a lot of control.
You know, if an administration was a kingdom, you know, well, yeah, you could do all these things, you know, but you know, this getting back to what I was talking about with transparency is that where are all these leaks coming from, you know? Or how are all these leaks happening? Why are all these leaks happening? It's bringing things to the forefront, and it is showing transparency. So maybe sometimes transparency doesn't come by the king, and if you don't have a king, by the president, you know. But transparency comes through anyway.
Comes through the citizens of this country.
Comes through the citizens of this country, you know. Now, whether they break a law on that transparency, well, they broke a law. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a broken law. Was it good or bad of what they do? Well, I'm not going to judge that because mm-hmm. they felt impelled to do that, mm-hmm. you know. And
somebody said it was the ultimate act of civil disobedience. I think I read that the other day.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, you know, the...
If that's a bad
you know,
thing,
as a personal labor, you know, I mean, I've spent 30 something years, almost 40 years, and watching people just be rolled over by other people, by their bosses, by corporate role and whatever,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and. Mm-hmm. Well, if they don't want to do something about it, that's up to them. But
right.
I can't sit back. Right. And that's why I say, you know, with these other people, you broke the law and you're going to have to do that.
Right.
But, you know, the fact is the information's out there. You know, you put the information out there. You know, you're a hero by some and you're a devil by the other. Mm. You know, that's just the way it is.
It's a tough question.
Yeah. Well, my father taught me, you know, wow, especially about labor and, you know, the work ethic. He said, Ed, when you stand up for your rights, you lose your seat. Just remember that. The reason you stand up is for the next son of a bitch that has to come behind you. Oops, sorry. The next SOB that has to come behind you and sit down. And that's what it's all about. And that's what our forefathers did. That's what every person, you know, every soldier of thought in every war we did. God, look at, you know, look at World War One, especially World War Two.
Right.
The ultimate sacrifice, you know, not for yourself, for whoever's going to sit in that chair behind you. So I think a lot of this gets down to ethics, personal ethics and personal integrity. You know, if people want to be rolled over, well, yeah, you can, you know, you can. Now, I was going to say drink the tea, but maybe you can drink tea or coffee. You know, it's like our founding fathers.
Right.
You know, they knew all the British subjects when they went to a place, and that's how they knew each other. The ones who drank tea were the tea party. So they knew when someone was drinking coffee, they were the American rebels.
Really?
You didn't know that?
No, I never even heard that.
That's a fact of history.
Yeah. But now, of course, it has nothing to do with the Tea Party. I mean, you know, it might be a coincidence that,
it's whatever you make it. It's whatever you make it. I'm part of, Occupy. You know, I'm part of the coffee party. So, you know, I'm not a Tea Partier by far.
Well, yeah.
You
know, well, that's going to lead me to an additional question. But, let's move on to that then, because it's in my head. It's about the government. I worked for the government for years as a contractor. You know, my father served, you know, for the government as well and worked for the government. We're just many generations of Washingtonians and now proud Baltimorean for the last over 24 years. But what I've seen in the government and what's been going on, from administration to administration, we always managed to make the trains run, no matter who was in office. Okay. Then came 2008, and I almost feel like the trains broke at that point. One of my concerns is that people don't understand that when you don't approve a budget, okay, when you pass a continuing resolution, that means is that each cabinet. Has to work at that level. So basically, a budget has not been passed since 2009.
Well, that's passed. They've been written every year.
They're
excellent budgets. I've got
everybody. They have not. No, everybody's working.
They're up on the White House site.
No. There is a distinction because what happens is that through the continuing resolution process, yes, they get a budget, but it's based on 2008 spending levels. And what also that means is that there is no ability to be able to move forward with new programs. Everything is frozen back in 2008.
So who is responsible for not passing the budget?
It's Congress. And the thing is
but did the budget get to Congress? It has. Every single time, and it's gotten there early every single time.
Right, it gets there, and the thing is that so these agencies, you go down there, except for maybe the DOD and okay, except for DOD, DHS, the Navy, and you know I serve those agencies as well, and you know I'm proudly serve those agencies, but a lot of these other agencies are really struggling. They know their computers are breaking down. They can't hire new people. They can't change. So it's almost like to them, time is frozen. to 2008. So in my mind, I'm wondering, you know, those folks in Congress, are they just trying to rewrite history? You know, are they just trying to keep it and they don't want to recognize that, you know, we got this new administration?
Oh, no, you know. I think it's pretty open and transparent that, you know, that the entire thing ever since then has been an ideological battle. You know, people that, and by the way, you know, people that you know, as you said before, you know, don't want government or a minimum government. You know what? There's a lot of Republicans I know and that I really liked, good statesmen, you know, throughout my life that I've seen early on and that I've read about. They didn't want a small government. They want a necessary government.
Right.
Okay. It's only the ultra right ideology, the Ayn Randian, the libertarian that says no government. What did that guy say about, you know, small enough to drag in a bathroom and kill it? You know what? Right. You know what? He's saying, I want to kill the people's voice. Because the only thing a government is, any government, is the administrative arm of the agreements between the people and the society. That's what a government is. Mm-hmm. You and I are the government. Everyone listening to us is the government.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The biggest treachery in this country that I've seen, especially in the last 30, 35 years, has been this big thing about, oh, the government's bad. No, the government's not bad. I don't say it. I've looked constantly, you know?
Right.
What is bad is people aren't paying their taxes. It's the people with the wherewithal. You know, people don't realize that. You know, during the 50s and 60s, up until JFK, right? After your first $2 to $5 million, depending on what year it was, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, after the first $5 million. You paid like anywhere from 87% to 92% taxes, right? It was Kennedy that brought it down to 70%, right?
And well, everybody after
$4 or $5 million, you know whether you know your first $4 or $5 million profit after that, you pay the whatever. Nobody complained back then. You know,
its effective tax rate was 70% across the board.
No, 87% to 92% after your first $4 or $5 billion.
Oh, okay,
right,
sure.
And it was a progressive tax before that.
Right. Well, that's what I was saying. Reagan brought it down from 70% to.
But who took it to 70? I mean, that was 20% right there. You know, right. and then that was President Kennedy.
Right.
Right. Now, but you know, you.
So he lowered the taxes for these.
He lowered the taxes, and it really wasn't tightening anything. It's just we had just such a big debt that we had to pay off previously from World War II.
Right,
and we had paid that off. We had started putting money into other areas. We had taken the tax down. You know. Now, you know, well, when Reagan got in there, you know, this is the big divide. You're talking about, you know, Republicans and conservatives. Now, from my life's experience living during those times, I had seen these people in the background that I really couldn't identify for the first couple of years. These people in the background, you know, with Reagan and helped Reagan get in there. And I soon found out, you know, who they were. They were... You know, Republicans have a name, Rhino, Republican name only. Well, that's kind of like why I consider these guys. Because there was a lot of Republicans and conservatives I liked. They were good statesmen. But these guys were ultra-right, capitalism, libertarian, the Chicago School. If you're familiar with that, Milton Friedman, the Chicago School.
Friedman's economist, wasn't he?
He was an economist, and he was him and Pinochet down in Chile. He was the one responsible for, you know, somewhat turn around Chile's economy, but at the cost of millions of people's lives, you know, and anybody that talked back, you know, mothers down there still have, you know, tens of thousands of children and husbands and whatever that have still been missing, you know, that they're finding in mass graves.
Well, it's a Laffer curve, right? I mean, that was like one of the fundamental things, the trickle-down economics. I mean, they used the Laffer curve. I remember that from college economics.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, well, what did we find out about trickle-down? It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Not only that, you know, what gets
we knew that back then. That's one of the times I got arrested on the lawn.
Okay. Well, good for you. But, you know, what gets me is what I have a problem with the Republicans is that, you know, he left with an actual fairly large deficit.
He's the only president that tripled the deficit. The deficit.
And so did George Bush. And the thing George
nearly doubled it. Okay. Nearly doubled it.
But the point is that, you know, these guys are the ones that profess they want less. They want less government.
Right.
And yet they're the ones doubling the debt all the time. Bill Clinton came along and got us in a surplus.
But the way he got us in the surplus was by everything that they said. They said if you raise taxes, right, nobody's going to want to work. Nobody's going to, you know, want the business. No, the opposite's true. Everything in history, not only this country, any country, you know, you invest, right? You're going to get money for your return.
Right.
And there's more and more people there.
Keynesian economics, a multiplier effect.
Yeah, if you look at when Clinton got out of office, we had a 10-year $6 trillion surplus projection.
Right.
Right.
What happened?
The guy after it put two wars on the bill.
Yes.
Gave two major tax breaks to the top percentage. This isn't political speak. This is factual. You can go to the Treasury Department. You can go to the General Accounting Office. You can look at any papers. You know, you can go to the IMF, or the International Monetary Fund. All these people have specific figures that they come up with. Not, you know, they just don't copy somebody else's figures. All the figures say the same. And we went from a $6 trillion surplus to a $6.8 trillion deficit. So that's $12 trillion.
No.
Now, when he first got in there, Bush first got in there, it was about $5.5 trillion was our deficit. And it was going down. It was going down at an alarming, you know, for the bankers at an alarming rate. But by the time he got out, it was $11 trillion.
Ridiculous.
You know?
That's entirely his fault, though. I mean, you know, but... Still, I mean, you got to look at the history.
I can't say it's one his fault only. He had a vice president behind it, and he had a majority in both houses of Congress behind it.
Yes.
But that was because, and this gets back to what I was started talking about. This, the whole thing has been about ideology. And it all started in 1973, when, you know, a group of very rich libertarian-leaning people started their plan. They started their plan with ALEC organization, A-L-E-C. Look it up, people. ALEC organization and the Heritage Foundation. And they started setting up in every state and on the federal level, they started setting up what they were calling, little shops, think tanks. And those think tanks were all about taking legislation in that state and on the federal level and watering it down over points of time. Case in point, FCC, the heart of the FCC.
Oh, right. That was a major thing when they cut back on the FCC.
But that didn't happen right away. Okay. First thing, in 1980, there was an equal number, 50, for no specific reason, 50 independent media organizations registered in this country. 50, right? First thing that happened when Reagan got in there and the Republican Congress, They started watering down, saying you can have more of it, of an area. You can own more of an area. Yeah, it used to be you could only get like 20% of an entire area for any kind of news that you put out.
Right.
And that's all you can own. Well, they started doing that.
Let me explain to the listeners some of the background behind this. It used to be in the good old days, anytime you had a radio show or TV, you had to give equal airtime to the different points of view. Am I correct about this?
That was part of what was called the the fairness doctrine.
Fairness doctrine, yeah. Right.
And the primary part of the fairness doctrine was that you cannot lie and you cannot mislead the public under the fairness doctrine. Well, in 1987, so many of the roles of the FCC were already watered down, the heart of the FCC, ever since the very first radio broadcast, right? Ever since the very first radio broadcast said you can't lie to the public, right? We're going to give you these free airwaves. Right, we're going to license them to you, but you can't lie or mislead the public. Oh. In 1987, in a Republican House and a Republican Senate, that was voted out.
Sure,
and it barely made it out. But their reasoning was, well, we're going to have the internet, and people can find truth on the internet.
Okay,
I mean, come on, listen to that truth on the internet.
Well, I mean,
internet's 50%. Just as with any media, you can get 50% lies, 50% truth. You know.
Well, why? Okay, so. You know, so what? You know, you're out there and you don't have to show both perspectives. Why? You know,
The fairness doctrine said you can show the other perspective as long as it's not a lie.
Right. Right. But, I mean, in the old days, it used to seem that, you know, the stations used to, you know, have equal time to both perspectives or at least, you know, something on both perspectives. And I think what's happened is this has leaned to more of a, you know, Murdoch and all those folks having a lead, you know, a lot more conservative journalism out there, preponderance of it, I'm not sure why, though, that would lead
to that. I wouldn't say conservative. I would say, I mean, because it's so much to the ultra-right of conservatism, But the thing is this, it all gets back to, thank you. It all gets back down to the what I started with about the Fourth Estate.
Okay,
you know, the Fourth Estate is our divining rod in this country.
Okay,
right, and it always has been. It's not part of the country. It's guaranteed by the country, but it is not the country, and it's our divining rod.
Wow.
And you know, United States had done real well for a long time. You know, because people were looking for the truth.
Right.
You know, not another perspective. You know, when the fairness doctrine was taken out of the FCC, the heart of the FCC role, the fairness doctrine, I still can't believe this as I say it.
Okay.
But when that was taken out, right there, you saw the immediate erosion of the Fourth Estate. Because the Fourth Estate, you know, that fairness doctrine was somewhat of a barrier to keep disease out. Of journalism, you know, you're always going to have, you know, some little sickness or whatever in a body, but you're not going to have a life-threatening disease. And that's, and the thing that kept that out, the antibiotic or the whatever you would call it, that kept journalism much cleaner and not bastardized was the fairness doctrine. Once you got rid of that, You can persuade anybody anything. That's why certain station or two they cannot get a news license in other countries. Okay. They may be in the other countries, but they're on they're not part of news. They're like a pay-per-view, whatever. Right. But they cannot get a license to do news in Canada, any place in Europe, Japan, Australia.
Okay.
Because they have laws that says you cannot lie. You cannot mislead the public.
Okay. Very fascinating. I've heard this before, how this has been a major thing in the liberties or the changes in our country during when that happened. Let's talk about something else that happened about that point, too, because When I was back in high school, I learned a really definitive definition between classic liberal versus conservative. And the thing was, is that, you know, I always understood, I always felt comfortable with that definition that, you know, Republicans like less government. And and the liberals were more comfortable with government and the concept that government is, more proactive. And the thing was, is and I also understood that, the conservative movement, you know, they had a tendency to be, you know, more moralistic, you know, more conservative meaning. They would have a tendency to, go to church more, but
not moral.
That's another question.
Telling somebody what they can do with their body, I don't think that's pretty moral.
At the time, I always felt comfortable because
talking about liberty.
Because of let me continue. This is funny, but. You make me lose my train of thought here. But all of a sudden, I never thought, because the Republicans felt like, okay, big government's bad, and we don't want big government and all our personal lives and all that stuff, that all of a sudden that became okay to do that if it was a matter of religion. And I saw that fundamental shift back when Reagan took office, that the moral majority and all that. And we were talking about some of that stuff.
Before the show today, we were speaking about the fact that there really wasn't a conglomeration of the religious right until they were all brought together just before the 1980 election.
Right. Absolutely.
And they were pretty much the ones responsible for Reagan getting in there, but they were all brought together by, people from ALEC and the Heritage Foundation,
So it goes back to that.
Yes, yes. And that, coincidentally, by the way, it's 1973. You also remember that's the year of Nixon, right?
Sure.
Nixon was one of the, Joseph Kors, he was the one put up the primary money for ALEC. And it's hard to find that information these days. I was swept up pretty good. But anyway, my point being,
what was
that? My point being that, people think that there was always a religious right because there was a religious belt. But they all believe different things. They just like the European religious wars, they agreed on 97% of the Bible, and they went to war on the last 3%, so they couldn't get together. Well, finally they were gotten together just before the 1980 election. They were the main thing that got Reagan elected, And ever since then, there's been a tight hoop on them, and you can see it, through a lot of things. Look at, look at the last 15 years, how every church is speaking out about this and speaking out about that. It's like, hey, wait a minute. We gave you a tax break. So, you can go over there and do what you want. But you're not going to get, I don't think they should get a damn tax break and then come here and tell us how to live. Didn't we get away from religious persecution?
Yes, sir.
That document says freedom of and freedom from. It doesn't say, just of or what. It says freedom of or freedom from. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a Catholic, not a practicing Catholic, but I assure you, I was raised a Catholic. I've got a lot of great information through Catholicism. I can show you the scars, But the thing is, there comes a time in your life where, you start to follow what, Catholicism says. In the New Testament, he says, go into your closet and pray. I don't see anything about, in the New Testament about when, help the poor unless they're having babies. Mm-hmm. Or, it's what a bastardization of
Yeah, it's confusing, isn't it?
Well, it's yeah. It's more confused. But see, that's where getting back to the very beginning. And that's where America and I think mankind is right now. I think we're in the final battle of truth versus falsehood, good versus non-good. And that's our consciousness.
Our soul, and we need to reread the preamble.
But, yeah, right. Well, I wouldn't say our soul, but it's just our consciousness. You know, you can when you judge something, you know, you better be right. You know, it's as simple as that. Or don't even judge at all. You know, I don't think I don't think anybody has the right to make somebody else see their viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's our own shortcomings if we don't see somebody else's viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And mankind in the United States, we are in our final battle, is what I see.
Mm-hmm.
And that is finding truth from falsehood.
But you said earlier, it's up to every generation to decide these things.
Exactly, so exactly. And this generation and the previous two generations, you know, I think are slowly getting to that.
Okay.
Whoever thought that the computer chip was going to bring about such a progression in the world of truth, you know, the computer chip, you know, also has 50% lies. But now people know that. Now people are learning to decipher truth from falsehood.
I mean, this is one of the reasons for the Arab Spring, they say, is because of all the new multimedia forms of communication.
Exactly.
Out there.
Exactly. We have instantaneous communication all over the world. Some of it's bogus, some of it's not. So what is mankind's job right now? And I think we're starting to do okay at it. Mankind's job right now is to recognize the difference between truth versus falsehood. I'm not going to say it's a lie. If somebody believes that, then really, you know, but it's not correct. So it's a falsehood,
right?
You know, the entire thing is we'll be going through this probably for the next at least 20-25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I've already seen in the last decade and a half, people jumped on the bandwagons as soon as, you know, whatever they heard.
Mm.
Nowadays, you see a lot of people going from one side to the other side or at least going to the middle because they're like, you know, I believed you SOBs over there and you told me all this and it's not true. I'm finding that out.
Right.
You know?
Right. Because of the internet, because of...
because of the proliferation of information. It's like, okay, you know, I've done a lot of work with... the Occupy movement, you know, the different Occupy movements and whatever. Occupy movement, you know, this is one of the bigger misunderstood things, but it's being bastardized ever since its inception. It's not about camping out. It's not about overthrowing. It's not about doing anything. It's only an information service.
Mm-hmm.
And the information that's been passed on to people, you know, and gotten people to wake up. That's why a lot of people say, yeah, what are you, liberal or whatever, you know. And I say I'm awake.
Okay.
I'm awake because, you know, I think, you know, I've done it enough. I've seen the big picture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say one is just like the other because they aren't, you know.
You believe in the fourth arm. What's the term?
The fourth estate.
The fourth estate. I'm sorry. I've never heard of that.
Really?
Term. Well, I'm not a journalist. You know, I.
No, well, it's, you know, it's well, that's not really in journalism, but, you know,
okay.
It's, but,
okay.
You know, it's, but, yeah, you know, people, you know, I've.
Well, I'm sure journalists like that fourth estate concept, you know.
Well, I mean? You know, but, you know, it's not constant. It's, you can see the intentionality of it. You know, if you go back to some of the notes and some, you know, what they've, you know, the founding fathers that sent letters back and forth and whatever, you know, they realized the importance of the media but somebody to keep themselves in check because they know power, you know, power can corrupt.
absolutely. And power always does corrupt. And then you always have the question, who watches the watchers? Power's corrupts. And I see a lot of that.
It takes the Messiah not to be corrupt with power. I'll put it that way.
But, who watches the watchers? That's a big issue.
But you can't assign somebody of your own body. That's kind of like you know.
Sure, absolutely.
That's kind of like George Bush saying to Dick Cheney, "Hey, watch and make sure what I do is legal."
Right.
Ask Valerie Plame.
Well, that's what Congress is. Unfortunately, is an awkward position of doing to a large degree. But then you have the other executive branches. Mm-hmm. So in theory,
I actually believe
the other branches.
I actually believe some of these. Right wing congressmen actually believe what they spew. I think there's probably about 20-25% of them actually believe what they say, and it just amazes me how a body of people can vote them in. What does that say about the people?
What do you mean? Give me an example of some of the things that they that they say that's gotten your goat lately.
Daryl Issa, he's still jumping around about Benghazi and whatever thing. He got two of his congressional committees and congressional hearings on that, and they found nothing. They found National Security, CIA, they fired that guy right away when they said, you're on leave. But he was fired, whatever. This was all. Okay. There was no government overthrow, And that, by the way, I wanted to interrupt you two or three times about the government. Like I say, the government, I can't see the government as being out there. As being somebody on the other side, the government is me. The government is you.
Okay,
right.
It's not some like entity. You're right, and I am in a lot of ways. I am the government.
But you are too.
You serve in the military,
But as I live and breathe, I pay taxes. I'm part of this government.
Right, because here we are,
American citizen,
practicing what we. The great American tradition that was founded in our nation's pubs, our nation's taverns. Yeah. We're practicing here. It's political discourse,
right?
And hopefully, we're gonna, we're helping some folks make sense of all this, and we also are expressing our own concerns, which is so critical,
right? Right. Especially now, like we started this conversation, in other countries, and I see that's one of the boons in most other countries is that there's such political discourse, and most of their people don't need like in America. You don't see slums, anywhere near you can find in one state in America throughout all Europe.
Sure, I've often wondered that.
But you get what you pay for. Everybody's on this big kick about, taking down my taxes, We pay the cheapest damn tax in the world by far. But, you get what you pay for.
Right.
When I lived in Germany, I was paying something like 40% total of my income. Wow. But you know what? I never needed anything. Wow. The streets were beautiful. The food was great. I go to a doctor anytime I want.
No, it's got
fixed. They would have conscience all over the country.
I had the same thing happen to me in Greece where I got in an accident and they were there. They took care of me and they didn't even want to give me any paperwork.
One of the reasons I see is that America, being out on its own, we've been sheltered. We've been sheltered from a lot of realities. Mm-hmm. You look at the world wars and you look at everybody in Europe. I used to wonder why are people so. Living so good in Europe. Why is everything so beautiful in Europe? Why are so people so neighborly? I mean, this is every country in Europe.
I mean, it's a great country, and it's nice to travel and everything. But
I live there.
No, I mean, our country is great to travel, and it's a big country and everything. Yeah. But I agree with you. I think we should do more traveling. We should get a broader perspective about things. Understand
what my primary point here is that America's never been bombed. The way, European, you know, you look at most countries in Europe and Japan, right? And some other countries, like after the Second World War, these people were living under the stars for months, maybe even a year or two before they got a roof over their head.
Yeah,
no food around. I mean, God, look at the Marshall Plan and everything. There was no food around. So when you got food, you ate a little, but your neighbor's sitting right next to you, and you both living under the stars. It's raining, it's snowing, or whatever. You gave a little food to them.
Well,
you know,
that's why we came over. That's why my relatives came over. You know, they came over. I think it was during after World War One.
Yeah,
you know, my Italian side,
right?
My German relatives and Dutch relatives before that, because of various reasons like that. You know, but we did go through a bit of I mean, well, it wasn't always so idyllic. We had the Industrial Revolution, we had the muckrakers, and, you know, so
what,
we,
here?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it always hasn't been totally great for the worker of America, you know.
I don't think it would be a comparison to World War II, these people learn the value of a human being.
Yeah.
And
immigrant memories is of our
being. Most people in America, oh my God, nearly all the people in America, I don't think they can fathom that. And I think that's why those governments are set up like that.
Mm.
You know, a parliamentary system is a great system because everybody gets a voice.
Wow.
Now, you know, I'm not saying ours is a bad system. Ours is what it is. But our system has one of two sides. You either vote yes or no.
Mm.
You know, if you're like, well, yes, maybe, or no, maybe, there's not a party for you.
Wow. Okay. No, I do enjoy traveling. I've gotten a chance to travel across the pond and to Europe a bit, and I've been very blessed to be able to do that. And also we've gotten to go to South America a bit. And I know what you're saying. In the world, it's a village. Everybody's very, you know, content to get together and,
should be, but there's only in this country, in the entire world, only in this country is there a faction that says, I am superior.
Wow.
And there should be no middle class, only in this country. I've not found another country that has a section of its people have that ideology.
I think the middle class, I disagree with you a bit, because I think the middle class thing is something that's threatened a bit recently. I think, you had with the establishment of Roosevelt and just up to recently that government services were there to kind of make that bridge, and I see that threatened a bit, and I also see the social mobility in this country threatened a bit because
I don't even get you what's
through the cuts of the government social nets.
But what does that have to do with the middle class?
Well, I just see that mobility. I think that there was a certain time in this country, maybe where it was easier to. For the mobility, our fathers were born with the dream that their children, fathers and mothers, born with the dream that our children are always going to do better than them.
Yeah. And that's the reason for the middle class.
Right. And I see that threatened a bit in this country.
The entire market that calmed down, if you ask me, was deliberate to get rid of the middle class.
Right. So I agree with you that there is a problem there, but I think that up to recently, the 80s, maybe because we keep talking about the 80s, is that dream of being able to, that social mobility has been threatened in this country, and it was there before. My father had that dream, and I see a lot of people.
Well, these dreams were spawned by, by. Promises, to the people that had been gotten through labor and the wars.
Sure, absolutely.
And that was fine until you had, like I said, you started with the 50s, the entire Ayn Randians, selfishness is good.
Right,
there should be no middle class,
Right.
Let them and the poor die, That entire ideology, that is something that's pretty much newborn in this country, you know. And the person who warned us about it was a Republican, one of the best statesmen I've ever known, Eisenhower.
Sure, he was. You know,
so I cannot, in any good conscience, you know, when I hear this this discussion about the right and the left and whatever, I can't call the right Republican. I can't. I just have a hard time, or even conservative. They're ultra right. You know, because the Republicans and conservatives that I know, even though I didn't agree with them, they were good statesmen.
Yes.
A statesman passes what needs to be passed in that time.
Right.
A politician will dig in and not do anything, even though he knows it's good for the country and it's overall good for his constituents. That's what they want. They're going to stick in the mud.
The ability to be able to work in, across the aisle, be able to reach across the aisle, work together.
But that's what you're supposed to do. And you're supposed to do that because you're supposed to do it in the time frame of your generation. And with the understanding that the next generation, 6-8 years, comes down the line, they want to change it, they can change it.
Right. Absolutely. You know,
that's what a statesman is. A politician will stick in the mud and stay right there because he says, you know, God tells me, you know, you shouldn't have an abortion. You know, you shouldn't kiss your neighbor. You know, God tells me. Yeah, you're going to stick in the mud. They're the ones I see destroying.
You're like a preacher, Ed. You wake me up at
that's what they say. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's for the other people out there that are listening to my drone voice falling asleep. But that's.
Listening on the internet.
Yeah. But that's, you know, that's the entire entire crux. We have gone so far to the right and ignored the general population, ignored the preamble.
Right.
The preamble of our Constitution, where I think we are gifted with someone who's slowly turning that around and it's coming back.
Okay. You know, which kind of brings us to it's full circle. And, you know, I really enjoyed talking politics. Actually, you spent a little more time than we thought today. Time flew so quickly.
And by the way, folks, this is how you talk about it. You debate it.
Right. Thank you.
And, you don't scream about it.
Right. No. And we're proud to be able to first do that type of tradition, first in our nation's taverns and pubs, and now here on Baltimore Internet Radio. On My Stoop with Ray. Ed, you know, it's been wonderful. I hope you come back on a fairly regular basis, and we'll continue this discussion. And you know, as our launch comes next month, we'll get these callers on board, and, you know, we'll, you know, maybe, you know, have some chats with them as well.
That's great. Maybe I'll bring my laptop with some notes, you know, ready-made notes for answers.
We'll talk to the folks in Baltimore and expats and also people around the globe, hopefully, to see what their concerns are. And, you know, maybe we could figure all this stuff out. So, anyway, it's been real fun. Thank you for stopping by on my stoop.
Thanks for letting me on your stoop.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ed.